I am J.A. Lovelock, a barrister, an author, but most importantly, a crime junkie. I love reading and I love crime, so what better way than to spend my time with crime writers and find out how they tick and how they marinate together characters, motives, killer instincts, murder suspects, and their comeuppance. Welcome to my podcast, Behind the Yellow Tape. In this episode of Behind the Yellow Tape, I speak with crime writer, the brilliant Martin Edwards, a man of many awards to match his humongous talents. Hello, Martin, the mighty Martin. Hello and welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us. I'm going to start, first of all, by asking, how many books have you written?
Well, what a wonderful introduction. Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be with you and delighted to be talking to you today. In terms of novels, I've written 19 novels. I've also written 9 non-fiction books, and I've edited 40 anthologies. So quite a mixture, really.
And all of those books have, I believe, rewarded you. You've won quite a lot of awards. Would you like to tell us a bit about some of those awards?
Well, the crime writing has gone very well in recent years. I've always, since being a small boy, wanted to be a crime writer, a crime novelist. But it's a long journey. And that journey began for me as a child. My first novel was published nearly 30 years ago, back in 1991. But in recent years, I have had a lot of good fortune with awards, both in the United States and in this country, for a book called The Golden Age of Murder, which was the story of the Detection Club in the 1930s. That was nonfiction, but also the short story Dagger, the Poirot Award, The Dagger in the Library, which is awarded by British librarians to crime novelists, one crime novelist each year. That's been running for about 30 years. And this year, really, the most wonderful of all, the Crime Writers Association Diamond Dagger, which is a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Oh, well done. Congratulations on that. So you started writing. When did you start to write?
Well, I really started as a small boy. I still have the some of the stories I wrote when I was 10 years old, the little mysteries I wrote. Naturally never published, but I started young. And that was really always my ambition. I did become a lawyer. I've been a solicitor for 40 years now.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that, because you are a law-abiding man, a solicitor, and then you turn to crime.
Well, that's right. I've never handled criminal law. I've always been an employment lawyer, and I've really got involved with employment law when it was kicking off in the early days, in the early 1980s. And my early publications were legal books and articles. But really, it was writing crime fiction in particular that was always my long-term ambition. And that's really what I wanted to do most. But of course, it takes a long time to get a novel published, let alone to establish a career as a novelist.
You said you started writing when you were small, but how did you keep going? What was it about crime and writing about crime that kept you going?
Well, I've always been fascinated by detective fiction. I read a lot of it, and I've read a lot of it since I discovered Agatha Christie as a small child. And I devoured all the books that she'd written in my youth. And then I turned to other writers when I ran out of Agatha Christie. And I started reading contemporary authors at the time. And it was that love of the mystery story, the puzzle story, but also some of the more complex crime novels that fueled my enthusiasm. And I like to tell stories. I think there's a touch of narrative in a lot of legal work, and certainly I think that's a parallel between the work of a novelist and writer and the work of a lawyer, the unfolding of a narrative on behalf of one's client. So I do think, you mentioned keeping going, and I do think that that's really the most important thing for any writer. I often say this to fellow writers, people who might be struggling, people who might despair, and it's something that all writers are very familiar with when you don't feel you're getting anywhere. But very, very few writers don't experience that at some point of their careers, and many feel it often. But the great thing is to keep going, to have faith in yourself, and to, if you really love writing and you enjoy it, then first and foremost, you're writing for your own satisfaction. You hope, of course, that what you write will entertain readers, but you have to love it yourself, I think. And I think the one thing I've always done, and of course, having a separate career has made this possible. I've not been dependent on writing for my income and my livelihood, at least not until recently. I think that it's about writing what you really believe in rather than what you think will suit the market or what publishers want you to write. So I think believing in your own ideas and what you're trying to do, if you keep at it, then of course, the more you write, the more accomplished you get, the more practice you have, the more experience you have, and so you tend to improve. And to me, writing is a process of constantly striving to improve and get better. That's really never ending. You can always improve a manuscript. You can always stretch yourself a bit more as a writer. And so that's what I've been trying to do for all these years.
Now, you mentioned Agatha Christie. Is that where you get your inspiration from, or other things?
Well, originally, that was the starting point as a small boy, the idea of the clues and the red herrings and the suspects, the small community, and then the surprise twist at the end. I always like a satisfactory twist ending that's been properly foreshadowed in the text. So it began with Agatha Christie. I'm still a great admirer of Agatha Christie. She achieved an enormous amount. Apart from anything else, it's often forgotten she's the most successful female playwright of all time, quite apart from all those novels. So I began there, but I also graduated to other perhaps more sophisticated forms of crime writing, and I enjoyed those equally. So I read psychological suspense, Patricia Highsmith and her modern disciples, American fiction, and fiction from all over the world. But as long as it's well written and entertaining, then it will appeal to me.
So do you draw on real life murder cases? And if so, which ones?
Well, on the whole, with fiction, the appeal for me has always been that it's escapism. You escape into your own world. You live, or certainly I live very much in my imagination, particularly during a pandemic. I think that's very appealing, to escape from the real world. And so I like making things up. So by and large, my novels don't draw on real life cases, but there are some exceptions to that. And one of those exceptions was a book I wrote probably about 15 years ago called Dancing for the Hangman, which was a novel, but it was told from the point of view of Dr. Crippen. And the idea of the story was to stick faithfully to the facts as far as they've been established, but to try to address, through the use of the writer's imagination, some of the things that are so baffling about that particular case, to try to explain what happened in psychologically believable terms. And that was a book that I really loved writing. I was very, very happy with it. It wasn't a particularly big selling book. It didn't achieve a lot in that sense, but it was a book that gave me a lot of satisfaction. And more recently, in a very, very different kind of novel, Mortmain Hall, which is the second in my latest series, I've introduced as subplot elements some storylines which are inspired indirectly by real life crimes, such as the Wallace case and the Rouse case and so on.
Mm-hmm. Now, I will talk a bit more about Mortmain Hall in a minute. But has there been a murder case that you know of that's had the most impact on you, and why?
Well, of course, the big difference, the gulf between fiction and non-fiction, is that in real life, murder is sordid and terrible. And in fiction, it's something different. It may be very sanitized, as it is in some of the Golden Age books, Agatha Christie and so on, or it may be quite dark, but it's still different from real life. And my own real life encounter, the one that sticks in my mind most, came back to me recently with the news of the death of the Yorkshire Ripper, Peter Sutcliffe. Now, I was a young man training to be a solicitor living in Leeds at the time, just before Sutcliffe was caught. And I vividly remember the impact that those crimes had on people in that part of Yorkshire, West Yorkshire, where most of the murders occurred. And women were afraid, and I knew people who were afraid. I remember one woman I didn't know asking me to escort her home from a bus one evening because she was just terrified. And that made a great impression on me. It was a terrible time for that community. And the impact that crime has on people, including the innocent. I knew somebody who was actually interviewed several times by the police because his car had been seen in certain areas, and he was entirely innocent of those crimes. Never committed a crime in his life, as far as I knew. But he came under very fleeting suspicion, as I'm sure literally hundreds, if not thousands, of men did. So what about the impact on their lives as well? Agatha Christie actually had a phrase for it. She wrote a book with this title, Ordeal by Innocence. The way that the people who are suspects but have actually committed no crime are affected by a murder that isn't solved. Mm. So that was, I've fortunately had no direct connections with murder cases in my own life, but that was the closest I came. And even though it's 40 years ago, I still remember it quite vividly.
I remember that as well, because I was living in Manchester at the time, and I was actually working in a law firm. And one of the girls said to me, she thought, you know, the voice that they had, somebody had rang in. And someone, one of the girls said, they thought it was one of our solicitors. Right. And they said, oh, no. And she said, don't be alone with him. Don't go in a room alone with him. It was. So yeah. I do remember that time as well.
Yes.
I do remember that time.
Yes, and it turned out to be a hoax.
Yes, yes.
A very cruel
Yes, it did. It did. Now, Rachel Savernake, shall we speak a bit about her?
Yeah.
Tell me about her.
Well, I decided a few years ago, having written one series set in Liverpool with Harry Devlin, one series set in the Lake District, which I continue to write, about cold cases set in Cumbria, I decided to try to do something different. The novel I'd written about Crippen was an attempt to do something different. It was a complete one-off, and I decided that I'd read so many Golden Age stories set in the 1930s. They were enjoying a revival. I'd published The Golden Age of Murder. I'd researched that period. I was pretty steeped in it. I thought it would be interesting to write a book set in that period. And I had an idea that I would try to write a novel in a very different way from my previous books. Most of them had been planned, at least to some extent. At the very least, I always knew who had committed the murder and why at the time I started writing the novel. I might not know a lot more than that, but that was my basic framework. This time I decided to have a different starting point altogether. Not the ending, but beginning with a character. And the idea I had was of this young woman, Rachel, who arrives in London. She's a rather mysterious figure. She's fabulously wealthy. She's got a small entourage of three devoted servants, but they're not really servants. They're more like friends, almost fellow conspirators. She arrives in London. She becomes involved in a sequence of bizarre murder mysteries. And it becomes apparent right at the outset that she's a very ruthless individual and that she has an agenda. But we don't know what the agenda is. And at the time, I didn't know what the agenda was either. But that was the starting point for the third book, a character. And I was very taken with that idea. I felt it was unusual. I felt it could make a good book of some description, some sort of mystery novel. But to begin with, because it was such a departure from the way that I'd written previously, I wrote a short story about the character just to see whether I enjoyed writing about her. And I did. I didn't try to get the short story published. I've never attempted that. But it was a way of trying to find out a little more about the character, trying to see whether I really enjoyed writing about her. And because I did, I set off on the novel that became Gallows Court. I had that title in my mind. I wasn't really sure what was going to happen at the place called Gallows Court. I didn't know that. But I had the character and I had the title. And so I set off from there. So it was, for me, a very different way of writing a novel. And as a result, it took a long time to write. It took 3 years. There's a lot of rewriting. I didn't have a contract. I didn't have a publisher because I was wanting to do something different entirely from what I'd done before. And fortunately, when I'd finished the book in the end, my agent loved it and he sent it to the leading publishers. And I was lucky because I got a great offer from a terrific publisher called Head of Zeus. They offered me a 2-book contract. Mm. So that was exciting. They published a special limited edition. They commissioned wonderful artwork for the cover. So it was very exciting and it turned out to be a breakthrough. It was nominated for the Historical Dagger. It was nominated for another award. Was reviewed very, very well. And so really, it became a great success. And it was a wonderful thing from my perspective, because it was a complete experiment. It was a great risk without a contract and without any guarantee that the book would even be published. Mm. But in the end, as I say, I was fortunate. It worked out, and it's worked out marvellously well for me. And the second book came along, Mortmain Hall, and I'm just about to start the third book. In fact, I've written a little bit of that third book.
Good, good. So I take it that you do like Rachel then as a character.
I do. And what I've done with Rachel, I've done this with my earlier books as well. Right at the outset, you don't know everything about Rachel. And even at the end of the first book, there are things to be discovered. And I've done that with other major characters in my novels, because I think it's very important to keep fresh as a writer and to keep yourself infused and to avoid being formulaic and just churning out the same thing. I always try, even when I'm writing books in a series, to do something a little bit different every time, because that's a way of keeping me enthusiastic about the books. And I think that if I'm enthusiastic, then hopefully the readers will be enthusiastic as well. They may get something a little bit different from last time, but that's not a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. So it's that freshness and little touches of originality that are very important to me. Trying to stretch a little bit further as a writer, trying to write in a different way, different methods, different approaches, experimenting with different viewpoints or story structures. So Mortmain Hall begins with an epilogue, for instance. That was one that I tried in that book, and I enjoyed that. I felt it worked. So I'm always trying to do different things with the books and to keep myself on my toes and to keep the readers on their toes as well. We never quite know what to expect.
I'm going to come back to that in a second, but you like Rachel as a character. Is there anything about her that frustrates you?
Certainly not frustrates, but she's an unusual character for a protagonist because she is exceptionally ruthless, and she does some very troublesome things. And I was very conscious that the way that she developed as a character, that was bound to be the case. And it's always a challenge for a writer when you write a character of that type. I think Patricia Highsmith experienced this with Tom Ripley, the talented Mr. Ripley. She wrote 5 books about that character, and she found various ways to try to keep Tom fresh. In my way of thinking, part of the solution, because Rachel isn't entirely lovable, to put it mildly, I think she's intriguing and attractive in many ways, but there is a dark side to her, a very, very dark side to her character and personality. And it seemed to me that that could be oppressive if it wasn't relieved in some way. And so, just as with Sherlock Holmes, you have Dr. Watson to lighten the load of this drug addict who's this brilliant maverick, but also rather cold. So in these stories, although he doesn't narrate the stories, we have Jacob Flint, the impetuous young journalist, who becomes fascinated by Rachel, wants to discover her secrets, is constantly outfoxed by Rachel. But I think he's, although he's naive and he makes mistakes, he makes bad choices, I think he's an appealing character. He's a character who allows me to introduce humour. There is humour, quite a lot of humour, I think, in the second book, not really in the first. And there will be humour in the third book as well. And I like writing humorous scenes to relieve some of the darkness. So that was my method, if you like, of trying to vary the register of the novels to offer some relief from the difficult scenes. There's very little graphic violence in my novels. There's a lot of talk about it, a lot of reference to it, but I don't write gory scenes generally. There's a lot of suggestion. Some people have said that I do write gory scenes, but actually, if you look at the books, they're not. I try to conjure up an image, but not through explicit description. That's my preference. So there is that element of darkness in these particular stories, but there is also some light as well, and there's fun and entertainment. I think there's quite a lot in these books, I think, and you can read them on a number of different levels if you're so inclined.
Yes. Now, you mentioned keeping things fresh.
Yes.
Would you then put some social current event in any of your books?
Well, there have always been subtext to my books. So the first series about Harry Devlin, the kind of background was that of Liverpool, a city which went through great traumas in the 1980s, rediscovering itself in the 1990s and the early part of the 21st century. In the Lake District book, the background element is the challenges faced by rural communities in the English countryside. There are many such challenges, and that's a background theme. But these things are there in the stories. They're not necessarily on the surface, really. They're there for people who are interested. And there's a lot of stuff about justice and the way the justice system works. How do we do justice in a complex society? And all that kind of thing, but they're not things that I want to preach about. I want to put these ingredients into the mix and let the reader take out of the books what they want. And it's very interesting to me that with Gallows Corp, first book about Rachel, in recent times, people have drawn parallels with the Me Too movement and that now the pandemic, because there's talk about the Spanish flu, the influenza pandemic of 1919 in that novel. But of course, these things weren't in my mind at the time I was writing the book. I was really trying to address issues on a deeper level rather than what's currently fashionable. I've never been a fashionable writer, really. Never sought to catch the current of the times in that way. I've tried to go for things that are happening in society beneath the surface, and which may, if I'm lucky, give the book some degree of longevity. And I've been very pleased when the early books have been reissued that sometimes reviewers have found something in them that reviewers of the time originally didn't find. And that, for me as an author, is extremely satisfying. It's enormously satisfying.
Right. Have you got a favourite fictional murder?
A favourite fictional representation of a real life crime or a fictional murder?
A fictional murder.
I think that it's difficult to look beyond Agatha Christie's bestseller, and then there were none, because that's a fascinating story which gripped me as a small boy because of the mystery. But really, in later life, when I thought about that novel, I don't want to give too much away. It's really about this eternal question that never goes away. If society and the mechanism of the justice system, the conventional law, fails to achieve true justice, how can we fill the gap? That's really what's behind that book. That's where the motivation for the story lies. It's something that Christie tackled, and other Golden Age writers tackled, on a number of occasions. In fact, so often, I think that it's no coincidence they were concerned about these issues, even if they didn't really articulate them explicitly in their fiction, because of course they were conscious of the rise of Hitler, the Nazis, the fascists, Mussolini, and they weren't for the most part talking directly about those things, but there was something in the air that filters through into the books, and Then There Were None is a brilliant example of it, I think, and a great story.
And do you wish you had written it?
I certainly do. And of course, many people have written books in that style, yeah, and continue to do to this present day. But it remains the landmark, I think.
Lovely. Do you watch crime shows on TV, by the way?
I do, very much so. I've of course, during the pandemic, I've had plenty of time to catch up. So I've been re-watching some things, as well as contemporary series. I've been watching The Unforgiven, the American series with Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant, which is quite interesting and certainly very well done. But I've also been re-watching shows of the past. I've been watching Spooks, the spy series, which I never watched when it was first out. And I'm enormously impressed by the script. They're so tight, in less than an hour. They cover a huge amount of ground. And I think they're a brilliant example of script writing at its best. So I'm working my way through Spooks at present. I'm up to series 3 right now.
Good for you. Now, let's talk a bit about your success and challenges as a crime writer.
Well, I think that writing is a very tough game. I was fortunate to be elected to be chair of the Crime Writers Association, a great privilege. And the reality, I've said this many times, is that there are a few very successful writers, but the vast majority, it's a struggle. And that's always been true, and it probably always will be. I think one of the important things in terms of associations like the CWA is to try to support the writers who are finding it difficult. And the same is true of organisations like the Society of Authors. The Royal Literary Fund does a great job in supporting authors who are going through tough times, because it is difficult to keep going. For every highly successful author, an Ian Rankin or a Peter Robinson or an Anne Cleves in the field of crime fiction, there are many, many more who find it very difficult. But Ian and Peter and Anne are all people who had a long journey themselves before they became so hugely successful. And I think that's something that illustrates the point that we were talking about earlier, that it's so crucial to keep at it, to keep the faith when financially and in morale terms and in every other sense, you feel quite despondent. It is important to believe in what you're doing. If you don't care enough about it, then I think give up, because there are plenty of easy ways to spend your time. But if you really do care, I think these challenges of being dropped by publishers, I've been dropped by a publisher more than once over the years, both in Britain and overseas. But I believed in what I was doing. And sooner or later, you might get a lucky break. Luck does play a big part in a writer's career. Luck with all sorts of things. Publishers, does your editor leave the company? Does that TV option turn into a series? All that kind of thing. With awards, there are fashions in awards. I think my work was deeply, deeply unfashionable for a very long time. Of late, I've been more fortunate, but that's the wheel of fortune. It keeps turning, and you go in and out of critical favour. So the great thing is to believe in what you're doing and try to absorb the setbacks. And difficult though it is to tell yourself that what you're doing has some value, even if very few people read it, it still has some value to you. And you never know what will happen in the future. That's the great thing about writing. It's full of unexpected twists and turns, just like a good mystery novel. And the twists and turns may sometimes be disappointing, but every now and then you get that lucky break, as I've had. I've had many in recent years. I feel very privileged and I struggle to believe some of the good fortune I've had, the Diamond Dagger, for instance. But it's about sticking with it and having that belief and faith in yourself.
Do you think there's room for more new crime writers?
Oh, absolutely. I think of that there is no doubt whatsoever. There will always be a demand for the new. And in fact, although it is difficult to break through as a new writer, I think there is at least an equal challenge for the established writer to remain relevant, because publishers like novelty. They do, and they may offer someone a great deal for a couple of books, but then if it doesn't work out commercially, they're looking for the next best thing. And that author who thought that, yeah, all was going well, is suddenly stranded. And this happens all too often. I've seen it happen many times. And this is really, in part, what's behind my belief that you need to keep that faith, because even if you break through as a new author, you want to keep going if you love it, and that's not straightforward. So yes, there is always room for new writers, but I like to think there's room for the established writers as well.
Thank you. One final question for you, Martin. You're walking down the road and you see a dead body. What do you do?
I immediately ring 999 because I'm not very brave, and that's the right thing to do.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Martin. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. Join us in our next episode for more fascinating and interesting matters that go on behind the yellow tape. Till then, you can keep in touch by emailing info@btytpodcast.com.
Hi, this is Amy and Vanessa from She Goes By Jane, where we shine light on the stories of missing and unidentified women. On November 7th, we're sharing Nahida's story for the first time in a podcast. And this is a story that I thought I knew, but after reading police reports, became more complicated than I thought. When investigators are called to Nahida Khatib's house, everything looks fine. Her purse is on the kitchen table, her cup of coffee is on the counter, and her two-year-old niece is in her playpen. The only thing amiss? Nahida is missing.
Every week, we feature a poem written in honor of the person we're talking about. This week, we're joined by one of our favorite actresses. You might know her from Sister Act or King of the Hill or The Descendants. But if you're like us, you'll know her from Hocus Pocus. She's the much-beloved Kathy Najimy. Join us November 7th to hear Nahida's story.